The Ohio primary concludes Tuesday, and the Republican primary for U.S. Senate is very close. Businessman Bernie Moreno, State Senator Matt Dolan, and Secretary of State Frank LaRose vying for the Republican nomination to face incumbent Sherrod Brown in the fall. The race features a lot of money, negative campaign ads, and dueling endorsements from former President Trump and Governor Mike DeWine. Welcome to the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable. I'm Glenn Forbes in for Mike McIntyre. We'll talk about the U.S. Senate GOP primary to start the show, then discuss how infighting among Ohio Republicans is playing out in state house primary races as well. Later, we'll discuss a settlement to a long-running class action lawsuit filed over conditions at the county jail described as deplorable, and a state lawmaker proposes a new bill aimed at red light traffic camera revenue. First, the news. It's the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Glenn Forbes in for Mike McIntyre. Thanks so much for joining us. The Ohio primary will conclude Tuesday. The contest between Bernie Moreno, Matt Dolan, and Frank LaRose for the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate is very close. A long-running power struggle with the Ohio House Republican Party playing out on ballots statewide. After 5 years, Cuyahoga County agrees to a settlement in a class action lawsuit over what former inmates have described as deplorable conditions at the county jail, and an Ohio lawmaker proposes a new bill to go after the money generated by red light and automated speed cameras. Joining me to talk about those stories and much more in studio, IdeaStream Deputy Editor for News, Stephanie Chekolinski. Good morning.
Good morning.
Here you are. And Akron-Canton reporter Anna Huntsman. Good morning, Anna.
Good morning.
And in Columbus, of course, State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Good morning, Karen.
Hey, good morning.
We don't take calls on the Friday roundtable, but please do send us your thoughts and on any of the topics to soi@ideastream.org. You can also find us on X, formerly Twitter, @SoundOfIdeas. Let's get started. We want to get to the primary in just a minute, but first, people across parts of Ohio dealing with the aftermath of severe storms that swept across the state last night. Nearly two dozen tornado warnings issued in those storms, including here in northeast Ohio. The hardest hit area, Logan County, about an hour outside of Columbus. A suspected tornado caused damage there. Plymouth and Huron and Richland counties also reporting damage from last night's storms. Ashland County with some damage as well. Karen, you covered the storms. We've been hearing you throughout the morning on NPR, so I'm sure you didn't get too much sleep. Three people are dead. The fear is that number could rise, Karen.
Yeah, and I think part of the danger of this was, of course, it happened in the dark, and this tornado tore through several counties, and now it hasn't, I guess it's not been officially confirmed as a tornado, but certainly tornado-like winds. There were videos that were posted on Twitter or X, whatever you're calling it now, that showed a very large funnel cloud that seemed to be pushing through the area. So there's a real concern here. Of course, the community is trying to come back together after this. A trailer park got hit pretty hard. There were some businesses that got hit, a car dealership, some buildings that are collapsed. So what we know right now is Logan County is confirming three dead, but also I believe there's some other areas that are also talking about fatalities. So there is not a final number. This is still a developing story.
And I heard in your report for NPR that Ohio Department of Transportation spokesperson Matt Bruning said they're using snow plows to move the debris. That gives you an idea of just how much debris there is.
Yeah, and the danger of that, of course, is, as I was talking to Matt last night, that it was in the dark, and people, as they were driving around, could have come up on some of these huge trees that had fallen down, and the easiest way to get them out of the way was just to go out with the snow plow and just move them along. And that does show some of the devastation that was happening in this area. And, you know, I think we expect a lot of this maybe in later March and April, you know, these spring storms, but this feels very early. And it was, I think, somewhat unexpected, though the National Weather Service did have alerts out, and we were under tornado watches and warnings here in Columbus and Central Ohio for most of yesterday evening.
Most of the damage in Central Ohio, we did mention Ashland and Richland counties with some damage as well. Go ahead, Karen.
But also Delaware County, which is a pretty heavily populated county, is reporting a lot of damage. Signs, I mean, my colleague Joe Ingles sent a picture to our group chat this morning of a sign at one of the high schools, the scoreboard, like, completely torn apart. I mean, there's a lot. These storms left a lot of damage, as they typically do, sadly.
Yeah, not too much here in Northeast Ohio. Stephanie, I know you're in Lakewood. I'm in Westlake. Just some rain, lightning here and there. Anna, you as well. In Akron, a little further south, but not too much damage there either.
No, I didn't see much damage at all driving in this morning. Just that dense fog made it for kind of a tricky commute. But as far as last night goes, the lightning was pretty big. The thunder pretty loud. But I think we weren't too bad. Yeah. But heart goes out to all those who are majorly affected.
Absolutely, and we'll be following those developments from the storm here on 89.7 WKSU. Stay tuned throughout the day. The Ohio primary, of course, just days away. While both President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump have secured enough primary wins to clinch their nominations and a 2024 rematch, much remains to be decided, of course. The big race here in Ohio, the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate. Businessman Bernie Moreno, State Senator Matt Dolan, and Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose involved in a very tight race. An expensive one, of course, as a lot of these high-profile races are. The winner on Tuesday will face Sherrod Brown this fall in a race that could potentially tip the balance of power in the U.S. Senate. We're going to get to all this mess around Bernie Moreno in just a minute. But, Karen, I wanted to start with Matt Dolan. We've seen some lead changes. The latest poll out shows Dolan on top by a small margin, but I should note Undecided is actually in the lead currently at 32%. But is Dolan's surge a bit of a surprise, Karen? When you think about the last GOP Senate primary, he finished behind eventual Senator J.D. Vance. He also finished a bit behind Josh Mandel. So this, I guess, a more favorable field for Matt Dolan. What's your take here?
Yeah, this is kind of similar to what we saw in 2022 in May, where Dolan seemed to be lagging toward the bottom of that seven-way pack and then surged at the end to come in third. This is, I think, in many ways a reflection of how much money is being spent in this campaign. You've got both Dolan and Moreno spending an awful lot of money, and a lot of money is being spent on their behalfs by outside groups. And I think that that's starting to show in the way that the lead has been bouncing back and forth. And the lead has actually moved since polling started happening in November. I mean, LaRose, Moreno, and Dolan have all led at one point. So this race is very tight, but that 32% undecided just really surprises me with all the money that's been spent. I mean, like $32 million spent on TV, cable, and other ads. And yet there's still 32%, a third of voters, who say that they may not vote. Now, this poll, the Emerson College poll, did note that while this 32% was undecided, these were registered voters, not likely voters. So there's a possibility that these people are just simply not going to vote because they haven't made up their mind. They don't know who to pick.
To get into some of the, I guess, complications and, let's just say, downright ugliness, Karen. So let's start here. Ohio's primary, it's an open primary. Voters can vote whichever ballot they request. So Democrats or independents can play a big role here. We learned yesterday Democrats are also involved in ad buys, and Governor Mike DeWine and others making a statement saying that Moreno is the weakest of the three. That's why the Democrats are, this pack aligned with Democrats is supporting Moreno. Last night, an AP story detailed Moreno's profile looking for men on an adult friend finder site. The AP reports a former intern of Moreno's did this as a prank several years ago, and the account was last accessed hours after it was created. The real focus of that article, though, Karen, Moreno has been very supportive of LGBTQ plus issues in the past, but of course, not in this election cycle. I just gave you a mouthful there, so I apologize. Can you make any sense of this whole mess around Bernie Moreno?
Well, that's the kind of thing that happens when there is a candidate who was in the lead or is in the lead. And there are other polls that show Moreno is in the lead. And, you know, internal polling on each candidate may show individual things to them. But this is an ugly time with a race that's this close. You're going to see allegations that may or may not be true. The AP covered this one, so there's some credibility here. And I think for a lot of folks, it's the issue of how Bernie Moreno went from being supportive of LGBTQ rights to being on the side of talking about indoctrination and all the things that a lot of the further right Republicans have talked about when it comes to the civil rights of LGBTQ people. So this is really a touchy story here. And we haven't heard anything from Bernie. He is going to be campaigning this weekend. He's campaigning with Donald Trump tomorrow in the Dayton area, and then campaigning with Senator J.D. Vance Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. Dolan's also doing a lot of campaigning this weekend with Governor Mike DeWine and former Senator Rob Portman, who's endorsed him as well. And then Frank LaRose doing campaigning. He's not endorsed by any of these political celebrities, if you want to call them that. He's endorsed by a lot of local and state folks. So this is going to be a busy weekend for those three guys.
I want to get to the endorsements in a minute, but the influence potentially of Democrats and independents, not only at in the ballots, Karen, for the actual election, but this whole idea that this Democratic PAC is supporting Bernie Moreno because they think Sherrod Brown has the better chance to beat Bernie Moreno. That was the big story yesterday. Sarah Donaldson, your colleague, reported on that. I mean, what to make of that? Again, it is, some of this is politics as usual, but this seems a little more, I guess, pointed, if that's the word.
Well, and it's a last-minute thing in a race that's tight, so that's kind of interesting. And you've got some Republicans who are accusing the PAC that's connected to Senate Democrats, U.S. Senate Democrats, and Chuck Schumer, the Senate leader, saying that this is meddling. This is a last-minute attempt to try to get your fingers in this vote. But it's not a huge surprise. I mean, the spending in this race has been all over the place in terms of pro candidates and against candidates. And so I'm not surprised to see Democrats rising to this, because, I mean, certainly if you're an incumbent, you want to face the candidate that you think you can beat. And if you're a challenger, you want to face the candidate you think you can beat. So it's not a huge surprise. This is going to be a very contested Senate seat because Democrats want to keep it and Republicans think they can take it away from Sherrod Brown.
On the endorsements, we've heard about the Trump bump and things like that, and Bernie Moreno may have benefited from that previously. The DeWine and Portman endorsement of Dolan, in your mind, Karen, is that part of the thing that helped, you know, part of the reason that propelled Dolan to the top? And ultimately, how do you see these endorsements playing out in the race? Do they have a big impact?
I'm not sure that endorsements mean anything to the average person. I mean, I think it is interesting to see the split there between DeWine and Portman going in the Dolan direction, and that is not the direction that former President Trump and Senator J.D. Vance have gone in terms of they have endorsed Bernie Moreno. For a while, it seemed like Moreno was really the one that was gaining the momentum when it came to endorsements, but these last two, DeWine and Portman, are a big deal. I mean, you could look back and say, hey, DeWine, he had a difficult primary in 2022. There were two candidates that ran to his right, and DeWine didn't have a huge win over those two, but he won in a landslide later in 2022. So he still has some popularity and some gravitas with Republican voters. And I think that we're seeing in polls that there is a segment of the Republican base that is very frustrated with former President Trump and wants to move on from him. And so I think Dolan has been trying to speak to that group of voters anyway. And, Dolan has always said that he did not seek out Trump's endorsement, but he supports Trump's policies. So to call him an anti-Trumper wouldn't be fair, but he's certainly less close to Trump than Bernie Moreno is and Frank LaRose tries to be.
Well, and he certainly has positioned himself both in the previous primary and in this one as that more, I don't want to say common sense, but I guess less extreme Republican, more maybe establishment, if you will. I know that can be a dirty word in Republican circles and things like that, but it previously seemed like there wasn't really a lane there for Matt Dolan, but now it seems like there is that lane there. Plus, I also want to mention, Karen, Moreno and Dolan are independently, I suppose you could say, wealthy, and they've been able to use their money to loan, to their campaigns, from their personal wealth for this stretch run. Meanwhile, LaRose is getting some financial help from a political action committee. Money always plays a big role in these, Karen.
Oh, absolutely. And this race is on track to be the most expensive U.S. Senate race in Ohio history. Already $56 million raised by the three candidates and Sherrod Brown. And the most expensive race was in 2022 when $71.6 million was raised. The larger chunk of that was raised by Tim Ryan, who ended up losing to J.D. Vance. So it isn't necessarily the person who gets the most money wins the race. But this is, like I said, going to be a very expensive race because of the importance of that seat in the Democrats keeping control of the Senate and the Republicans getting control of the Senate. And the poll that came out, the Emerson College poll, which I look at pretty seriously because they were pretty accurate in 2022 in May in the primary. That poll came out before the DeWine endorsement. It was done before the DeWine endorsement. So I'm not sure that the DeWine endorsement had a huge impact on those voters, but it's notable to say that that was actually done before DeWine came out and said he was endorsing Dolan, even though he had said a couple weeks ago that he may not endorse in the race at all because all three of the candidates in the race were very competent candidates.
I want to get to the state house races and this infighting among Ohio Republicans. Before we do that, Karen, though, I want to ask, do we know anything about how engaged the electorate may be as we begin this 2024 election cycle? Are we hearing anything about turnout, early voting? What do we know, if anything?
Well, early voting, I'm having some trouble understanding some of the numbers that I've gotten from the Secretary of State's office because they're different than numbers that are being reported by Cleveland.com. It looks like turnout has been pretty brisk, not completely unexpected for a contested primary where the race is tight, but interesting to note because there really isn't a presidential primary anymore. I mean, yes, Donald Trump and Joe Biden are on the ballot, but I mean, the race is set. And so you don't have people coming out to vote for that race hoping to decide it because that's over. So the main race here is the U.S. Senate race and then some of the state house races. I hope there's interest in those because I always tell people how important what happens here at the state house is. And there also is a contested Democratic primary for Ohio Supreme Court. But, you know, I'm interested to see what the turnout actually turns out to be.
So we do want to talk about the state house and this long-running power struggle within the Ohio Republican Party that's playing out on ballot statewide. There are some primary challenges stemming from the bitter battle over the Ohio House speakership won by Jason Stevens. Karen, we've talked at length on the show about the split in the Republican Party over the speakership. Republicans who backed Speaker Stevens over Derek Maron, they're seeing some of these challenges, of course.
Yeah, and that was not unexpected at all. I think there were 22 Republican incumbents who joined the 32 Democrats in the House to vote for Jason Stevens for Speaker on the floor, even though the caucus had agreed to vote for Derek Maron in a vote in the caucus a couple weeks before that. And so that group of 22, the Ohio Republican Party has referred to them as the Blue 22, and there's been some pretty bitter campaigning going on, where you've got about 11 of those 22 who are facing primary challenges. And some of them have gotten pretty bitter, like I said. I mean, you've got Americans for Prosperity, which is a group that has a lot of money. It's getting involved in these races. Senate President Matt Huffman, he's term limited in the Senate. He's running unopposed for the House. And it's expected that if he and Jason Stevens both win, he'll challenge Stevens for Speaker. And apparently some of his money and support is going to the candidates who are opposing those who voted for Stevens. So the power struggle is real here. And it's been an underlying really theme going on for the last year and 3 months on how little legislation is moving forward because there is this struggle. And the supporters of Maron had tried to get control over the House Republican Caucus's campaign account, which has about $3 million in it, so that they could boost their candidates over the Stevens candidates. They weren't able to do that. A Franklin County judge said Stevens and his people retain control of that, but there's still a lot of money in this race, from what I understand. All these races.
Yeah, and before we get to Anna Huntsman on some of the local races, Karen, I wanted to ask you if there is confusion among the voters when you're seeing a couple, you know, Republicans on the ballot. What has the messaging been like, and is it clear to voters that this is a, you know, kind of Stevens versus Maron, result of this battle?
Well, one of the flyers that I've seen features one of the representatives who supported Stevens, a guy named Jeff LeRae from the southern central Ohio area. And he's positioned as a marionette with Joe Biden pulling the strings, which is just hilarious because the Blue 22, the so-called Blue 22, they are not liberal. I mean, all of the people in these races are conservatives. They're Republicans. And so the idea that somehow they're being controlled by Democrats because they wanted to work with Democrats to elect one person speaker over another person is just kind of interesting. So it's gotten pretty ugly in some races. There's a race out of the Toledo area that features Representative Haraz Gambari against challenger Sally Culling. And the Ohio Chamber of Commerce had to step into that one and tell Gambari to remove their logo from his campaign literature because they did not endorse him and they've endorsed Culling. So it's getting really, really touchy here. There's a lot going on.
Anna, the one you've been following here locally, incumbent Gail Pavliga, challenger Heidi Workman, how are these issues playing out in that race?
Yeah, there's actually quite a few locally that are all part of this. You mentioned Gail Pavliga. She's seeking her third term. She represents Portage County. She was surprised that the Ohio Republican Party didn't endorse her, as they declined to endorse many of these, quote, Blue 22 candidates. She was one of the representatives who did not, who voted for Stevens. I also wanted to point out, though, a kind of an interesting part here is that former Representative Bob Young was also part of the 22 Republicans. He's in Green Township. He resigned last year. He was later convicted of domestic violence for hitting his wife. So his seat is open. And this has been kind of going on for some time. Stevens did not take the nomination from the Summit County Republican Party to fill the seat. So that seat has been open for months. And the underlying idea here is that it's because he maybe wasn't sure that Jack Daniels, the nominee, would eventually vote for him again for re-election. So Jack Daniels is running. Mary Stormer is his challenger. Both of them told me that they would most likely vote with the Republican caucus, but that they make their own decisions in the caucus. So I just wanted to point that one out because I've kind of followed that one intensely here. But yes, it's Pavliga, and Heidi Workman is her challenger. She's calling herself a grassroots organizer here, saying that she more so aligns with conservative values. Another one locally here is in Medina, incumbent Sharon Ray facing a challenge from Gary Fox. Now, Sharon Ray didn't back Stevens, but she is close to him, and so the Republican Party didn't endorse her either. So it's just kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's kind of straight. Go ahead, Karen. I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. Yeah.
Sure. I mean, some of these races, too, there's individual races that are really interesting. You've got Sarah Carruthers, who's in the Southwest Ohio area. And Southwest Ohio, outside of Cincinnati, is pretty red. So she was a Stevens supporter. She's facing a pastor named Diane Mullins, who's made some really inflammatory remarks about LGBTQ people and really brought her religion. She's a pastor of a church, brought her religion into this campaign. And so that's a really interesting race. You also have in that same area in the Senate, which gets away from the speaker drama in the House, but it's still kind of connected because, like I said, Matt Huffman is possibly going to run for speaker if he and Jason Stevens are both elected. There's this race between incumbent George Lang and former state lawmaker Candace Keller, who, if you follow state politics at all, you've probably heard of her. She was one of the architects of the 6-week abortion ban. She runs a so-called crisis pregnancy center, and that race has gotten really ugly and crazy with, voicemails being exchanged and all sorts of things that have just really been very interesting to watch.
Well, Karen, and just like everything else, right? I mean, this comes down to power and money, right? I mean, you talk about control of the purse strings, right? The Ohio House Republicans Alliance. And also there's potentially coming out of this a pitched speakership challenge between Speaker Stevens and current Senate President Matt Huffman. So again, money and power, Karen.
Oh, absolutely. And this is the kind of thing that does happen when you have supermajorities, because especially when you get into a situation where you've got primary challenges, primaries tend to bring out voters on the extreme, both the left and the right. And so you end up with candidates who could potentially be on those extremes and trying, you see candidates really kind of going in those extreme areas to try to get those voters and then hoping if they win, they can pull it back toward the center. But this is the kind of thing that you're going to see when you've got a lot of people in one party who are kind of jockeying for position and power. And I'll be interested to see on that note, when you look forward to 2026, when all of the Republicans who are in the statewide executive offices, governor, attorney general, auditor, secretary of state, treasurer, when they start figuring out what they're going to run for next. And it could be the same kind of thing where you've got real ugliness going on because people are jockeying for positions and trying to take them when it's their party that's really in charge. They're just trying to move up in their party.
I just want to jump in and make a general comment here. And it kind of, you kind of already talked about it, Karen, with playing to the extremes in the primary, going more toward the center and the general. However, it just, as I'm reporting on this, it just kind of makes me wonder, A, how much voters are paying attention and care about the Republican candidates who didn't go with the Republican caucus and voted for Stevens. Because don't you hear all the time that people are saying, we want people to work, we want bipartisanship, we want people to work together. And then you have these challenges where candidates are saying, well, this person isn't loyal to the Republican Party, this person isn't conservative enough. And it just feels like this cycle of people saying there's too much polarization. We want our legislators to work together. And then you hear this in the primary. And I just wonder, I don't have an answer to this. I just wanted to make the comment because it's something that's been on my mind in my reporting. How much are voters, you know, how much does this actually impact voters and what do voters really want, I guess, when it comes to polarization?
I think there's a frustration because at some point it seems like bipartisanship and compromise really became concepts that no one wanted to engage in. And I think polls continue to show that that's what voters want. But of course, like I said, in primaries, you get the more extreme voters who are possibly more aligned with that idea of if you work with the other party, you're compromising your principles. And when I sat down with Secretary of State Frank LaRose for our TV show, The State of Ohio, talking about the U.S. Senate race, I was asking him about his reputation years ago. He had been Mr. Bipartisan and Mr. Civility in government. And now, for some people, he has taken on a role that they think is too partisan, too extreme. And he once again talked about how he's willing to work with members of the other party. But the messaging that comes out, especially in ads and especially in campaign appearances, really makes it sound like the other party is the bad guys. And that's been kind of a running narrative here, is that the other people, the other guys are evil, they're bad, they're wrong. Our party is the good party. You need to support our party. And that's a lot of what you see in, I think, primary messaging.
Gotta love these election cycles. And it, of course, does not end with Tuesday. Tuesday, a big day, of course, for the primary. But we'll be following this, of course, next week and throughout the rest of the year as we head toward the general election in November. Karen, Anna, thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. Oh, go ahead, Karen.
I just wanted to flag my State House News Bureau colleague, Joe Ingles, did two pieces, one on the Senate contests and one on the House contests, kind of laying out some of this stuff. And it's on our website, statenews.org. And I just really wanted to bring that out there because there are so many people who don't know who their state representative is, who don't know who their state senator is. And these are people that you probably should know.
Absolutely. And more resources, including a voting guide and candidate profiles on our website, ideastream.org. Early voting, you can still do that through the weekend. There is no in-person early voting on Monday, but you can do so through Sunday. So we are going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we will talk with Stephanie Chekolinski, trust me, on the Cuyahoga County settlement with the county jail. That's been a story that's been ongoing for a long time. This is the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable. I'm Glenn Forbes and for Mike McIntyre, and we'll be right back. It's the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable from IdeaStream Public Media. And for Mike McIntyre, I'm Glenn Forbes, joined this week by Anna Huntsman and Stephanie Chekolinski from IdeaStream and State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Before we get back to roundtabling, wanted to let you know about something new, the IdeaStream News Quiz. You can find it now at ideastream.org/quiz, ideastream.org/quiz. Feel free to click the button after you take that quiz to be notified when it drops each week. Of course, listen to the Reporters Roundtable every week before you take the quiz. It's like your homework. We're like an audio cheat sheet. Right.
Right. And everyone who isn't listening right now is going to do so bad. And then you can embarrass them on social media. Or maybe I'm just really competitive when it comes to games.
Thank you, Anna Huntsman. That's why you're on the round table.
That's why we're
so
friends,
often.
Anna.
Yes. Very good. So Cuyahoga County, Stephanie Chekolinski, has settled a class action lawsuit filed in 2018 over conditions at the county jail. U.S. Marshals report called that, quote, deplorable at the time. County Council approved the terms of the settlement this week. The lawsuit came after that report detailed inhumane and overcrowded conditions in 2018. The county says they've been, you know, working toward fixing that since that report came out. Stephanie, this lawsuit settlement, it's focused on changing procedures and conditions at the jail. And again, that has been the theme for these last 6 years.
Yes. In fact, they held the lead plaintiff. It's a class action lawsuit filed in 2018. They had a press conference earlier this week with the lead plaintiff, and she talked about how that was really what motivated her, that she really wanted to see change. She's worried that that people could be badly injured or die there. And the settlement itself didn't include a monetary award for the plaintiffs. It did include a $175,000 payment for, I think, attorney's fees. But really what the plaintiffs were looking for was improved conditions for the people who are being held in that jail.
You know, staffing has been a big issue as well. There was a problem with the medical care previously. They brought in MetroHealth to help there. And, of course, anytime you talk about the prison system, really anytime you talk about anything, but especially when you talk about the prison system, there's a concern over the amount of, you know, corrections officers, you know, ratios and things like that. How does this address staffing in the jails?
Well, part of this, you were just talking about that report. Part of this settlement was a report that came out, whether it was made public to us just recently as part of the settlement, but has been available to the county officials since, I think, a couple of years, maybe about 2 years. And in there, it talked about the design of the jail, the way that it's run, and how, you know, it just isn't, it because of the way it's set up, it requires more people to run it. It's inefficient. And so, you know, the jail itself needs more people to keep it staffed in a safe way.
What about some of those transparency issues that you mentioned? How will the public be informed about the progress on this? What's the monitoring like here?
Yeah, so they're gonna hire a monitor who's going to make reports, twice yearly reports, and those are going to be public to talk about the progress that they're making as they improve conditions in the jail. They're also going to start with some inspections that are within 180 days. Those reports are also going to be made public. And the attorney, the lead attorney on this case, talked about transparency as being a way to, you know, hold people accountable for really making the changes that need to happen in the jail. The lead plaintiff herself talked during that press conference about, you know, how they've been promising change, but, you know, community members just don't see it. And so they're hoping that transparency itself will, you know, force changes for people being held.
As I mentioned, this has been ongoing for a while. There's talk about, you know, the medical care, the food that was sometimes used to withhold punishment withheld inmates accusing them of withholding food for punishment and things like that. Let's talk a little bit more about some of the progress that has been made. Again, there's this idea that we could potentially, there's a site in Garfield Heights, the Cuyahoga County would build a new jail there. But my understanding is this is more about treatment. You know, that facility would help, but
sure.
This is more about the treatment of the inmates and kind of how they're being handled.
Yeah, there has been some, we think. Matt, our reporter, Matt Richmond, has been following this for some time, and he through his reporting and then some of the things that were said in the press conferences and so forth, he thinks that one of the criteria, for example, is that inmates, whenever they're coming in, be screened for medical problems. And he says, you know, that was one of the requirements, and that appears to have been something that's already been taken care of and put into practice. So in terms of those sorts of conditions and those sorts of improvements, the county does appear to have started along a path of improving things.
Any response from the plaintiffs in this lawsuit afterward?
The plaintiffs?
Yeah. It just responds to the settlement, yeah.
Oh, certainly. I mean, the plaintiff, you know, she talked during that press release about, you know, being pleased, you know, that they agreed to make improvements, but also sort of took a wait and see kind of position. She said that, you know, there have been promises previously that things are going to get better there. And you know, she just hasn't seen it. And to be fair, she was in jail for about 8 months, I believe. And in that time, 11 people died. And so she's talking about some pretty concerning conditions. And so her skepticism, I suppose, is warranted.
Sure. Stephanie, thank you very much. Moving to Akron, Mayor Shamus Malik has presented his first operating budget proposal to City Council. Important that word there, proposal. The $815 million spending plan calls for a 1.2% increase in spending. And a big focus in this budget is hiring staff. We just talked a little bit about that, including adding 30-plus positions.
Correct. So this is the net of 30-plus positions. So this is across city departments. A big highlight here is the police and fire hires that are currently now on the out on the streets, some of the largest in decades. There's also some a proposal for more positions, though, in the mayor's cabinet. So I think about 8 new positions. Malik did get eliminated some former positions, created some new ones, and basically says that he has lots of goals for the city to become more collaborative and better for its citizens, and he needs the people.
And they're hoping, Shamus Malik, the mayor, is hoping for increased tax revenue to help offset this. So how's the money going to work here, Anna?
He's saying that, and it's not just him, it's the finance department. You know, they work on this for months, saying that they're anticipating that both property tax revenue but also income tax are going to be increased this year. And so they're hoping that will help offset the cost to hire these more people and have these efforts on retention. I did want to say that, as you mentioned, it's a proposal. And so it's City Council has been in these hearings all week learning more about the budget. And then they're actually going to have a town hall discussion next week where the community can provide input. We'll see how much it will actually change, but it has to be passed by the end of March. And one of the biggest concerns so far has been about these new positions in the mayor's office and hiring these new people and saying, do we really need to be spending this money on these extra positions? The mayor's office says, yes, we do need these positions. Again, you know, there's oftentimes, you know, we see it here at any company. There's many projects you want to get done, but if you just don't have all the people that can really devote to education, housing, transparency, that's one of the positions is data and transparency. They're saying that we need the people. But there's been several council members actually who have come out and said that we're not sure we can justify this to our constituents, this big expense in the mayor's office specifically. So we, if I were a betting woman, I would bet that we might see some compromise there in the next few weeks, but I'll be watching to see how it plays out.
Are you not a betting woman?
Not typically.
Not really.
Not typically, but you know,
just wanted to know.
I like to hypothesize.
It is March Madness time, by the way. So
that's
just
true.
But anyway, back to the important
Kent State
things
all
on
the
this.
Way.
There you go. Hopefully we get to that a little later on in the show. Raises for workers, there's a potential for that. You know, because
cost of living.
Right. And just as we've seen in Cleveland, you know, retention is a big issue. You mentioned that, but also public safety and education, a focus in this budget, which also kind of mirrors some other cities that we've been following.
Yeah. Mayor Malik has some goals with universal pre-K that he wants to implement. He also wants to do more with the out of school network in Akron Public Schools and just more opportunities for youth. And so there is a position that they want to hire and possibly that they've shuffled some people around to focus on education specifically. And then, as you mentioned, they've budgeted for more. Well, they have the police. They just have to cover that in the budget now. Some other things, other departments that want to hire people. The municipal court is wanting to hire a mediator and a housing specialist. And this is something we've seen a lot in Akron. There's lots of discussions around housing. There's a lot of people experiencing homelessness. And both the previous Mayor Horgan and now current Mayor Malik have talked about wanting right to counsel. So that is potentially something that's coming down the pike if this housing specialist is hired. And Akron City Council wants a public policy specialist. So just a couple other positions there to highlight.
And public hearings coming up on this, correct?
It's actually, they just concluded yesterday.
Okay.
So look for my coverage.
Gotcha. Very good. Thank you very much, Anna. Wanted to mention as well, Marcia Fudge, President Biden's Secretary for Housing and Urban Development, says she will step down from her position next week. Fudge has spent 5 decades in public service, beginning as mayor of Warrensville Heights and rising up to Congress and then the Biden administration. She's 71 years old. I thought this was interesting, too. I remember covering this several years ago. She lobbied to become the head of the Department of Agriculture. That's what she wanted due to her experience with food and nutrition programs. That was back in 2020. She chaired the House Agricultural Subcommittee. That became a little contentious. Critics argue now she didn't have strong connections to housing. But at 71, Anna, is just kind of time for her to retire.
And this is interesting. I just saw Marcia Fudge just a few weeks ago. She was with Congresswoman Amelia Sykes. They were in Akron talking about housing. For me, I was a little bit surprised to see that she was resigning. But as far as we know, as far as what she said publicly, she wants to transition to being a private citizen. I mean, she's 71. She's been doing this for a very long time. She says she's been in every level of government and wants to be a private citizen now. So that's what we know.
Stephanie, housing always such a big issue. Were there any was Fudge able to do anything to boost home affordability?
Well, that's what the White House credited her with. They sent out a press release announcing that she was going to be stepping down, and they said that she had done a lot of work to increase the supply of affordable housing, and then also to meet the needs of people who, you know, that protect the housing of the most vulnerable.
All right, very good. Want to get back to some state house issues. State Representative Tom Patton, a Strongsville Republican, proposing a bill that would go after companies that run red light and speed cameras for cities. This has been a long time project of his. Patton says the companies, some of which are based outside the U.S., bring in millions a year. Karen Kassler, what are some of the proposals in this new bill?
Well, the bill basically would say that every camera has to be licensed and calibrated, and that's a way then that the state could keep track of just how many cameras there are, and also that these companies would need to send out tickets within 72 hours. Patton is a longtime opponent of traffic cameras. He introduced 7 traffic camera bills in 2022. None of them passed, but they would have done things like banning cameras for communities that don't have a fire department or EMS, banning cameras for communities that have less than 200 residents, setting the maximum number of tickets issued at twice the population of the community. He says some communities are sending out far more tickets than even the residents who live there. He's been tilting against traffic cameras for a long time. So this, he says, is a way to keep an idea of how many traffic cameras there are out there. And there's money that he says is going to go from these companies, many of which are overseas, to license these cameras. There's a $100,000 license fee, $5,000 a month for calibration. That money would go to the Ohio Department of Public Safety that would manage those things. So this is just, it's an effort, he says, to go after the companies that he says are taking the money away from communities and not necessarily the communities themselves that are operating cameras.
Right, and create a little more, you know, revenue for the state. And as you said, for some of these safety programs, go ahead, but real quick, do we have any data on whether the cameras have improved safety?
Well, and that's the struggle over this. And this is a truly bipartisan issue because you've got Republicans and Democrats on both sides of this. Cities have largely said cameras that we've run have improved safety on the streets and at major intersections where they've been posted. And opponents have said, no, this is just a cash grab because when you move the cameras, the intersections aren't any safer. And so this back and forth has been going on for, I mean, at least a decade now. And some communities have done traffic camera programs and then stopped doing them. Cleveland actually put it before voters and they rejected the camera program. And other communities are now even considering starting camera programs because there's a lot of money potentially here. And the question of whether it really does improve safety is a legitimate one. So but state lawmakers have really wanted to get into this and set regulations that they say would be fair. There was one big one that came through and was upheld by the Ohio Supreme Court that said that the state can actually withhold the money that it sends to communities by the same amount that the community raises through traffic cameras.
Karen, thanks so much. We'll continue to follow that, of course, and Tom Patton's campaign against his long-running campaign against the red light cameras. When we come back, we'll talk about everyone's favorite topic, the upcoming solar eclipse, and how the state is preparing to keep people safe amid this crush of visitors that we'll be experiencing in just a few weeks here. This is the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable. I'm Glenn Forbes in for Mike McIntyre, and we'll be right back. It's the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Glenn Forbes in for Mike McIntyre, joined this week by Karen Kessler, Stephanie Chekolinski, and Anna Huntsman. We're counting down to the April 8th solar eclipse. Karen, counting down to the eclipse and to the Guardians home opener.
You bet.
On April 8th. It's still amazing to me that these two things are on the same day, but I'm sure, well, and we have
I think it's a sign. I think it's a sign of how great the Guardians are going to be this year, that everything's just, I'm hoping.
Despite the four injuries to pitchers that they announced yesterday.
No,
maybe we'll get into
that. It's a dark future.
A little bit later, too. Now, interestingly, I mean, this eclipse prep has been something else. Earlier this week, we had representatives from the Highway Patrol, Emergency Management, and the Ohio Department of Transportation giving a briefing on the public safety plan for the eclipse. Anna, we'll start with you. The biggest concern appears to be the traffic, right? Now, what they're saying is people are going to trickle in before the eclipse on April 8th, but then after it's over, everybody's going to leave town, and that could be a problem. As I should mention, that the women's Final Four is going to be here as well.
I wanted to point that out, too.
Yeah. It's going to be kind of a crazy time in Cleveland. But Anna, the message here for people, plan ahead and make sure you're gassed up, your vehicle, and all that stuff, because not only are there going to be a bunch of people here you know, before the eclipse, but then April 8th after it ends, just kind of the amount of people that will be leaving the area.
Yeah, you basically said it, Glenn. No, I'm just teasing. Yeah, they're basically saying
I stole your thunder.
You stole my thunder.
I'm
no,
sorry.
I'm just teasing. No, I'm just totally teasing. Yeah, they're saying to come early and stay late. They're hoping that people will kind of stagger their travel, and so that there won't be this huge, you know, rush to get out of the Northeast Ohio area, all of Ohio, actually, on April 8th. And businesses and museums and science centers are really trying to take advantage of the fact that we are anticipating having so many people coming to the area. You've seen eclipse watch parties. There's all kinds of events going on. So for people here locally that actually live in this area and aren't traveling, they might be heading out to one of those events. And for those people, health officials, emergency officials are saying, stay home, watch it at home, because you're just going to be adding to that expected congestion.
They're talking about potentially hundreds of thousands of visitors coming into the area. And here at IdeaStream, we've been doing a lot of reporting on the demand for hotels and Airbnb rentals, Anna.
Correct. And so I will say that there are, as far as we know, still hotel rooms and Airbnb rooms available at this point, but there's been a huge demand and they are scarce. And because of that, the prices are really expensive at this point. So yeah, there's a huge demand for hotels. Airbnb is preparing. I did a story. They actually came out with a report last week or 2 weeks ago, showing the top cities that people are traveling to based on their data. And Cleveland is actually in the top five in the U.S. People are wanting to come here to watch the eclipse, and Airbnb owners are telling me that sometimes people want a house to stay in, or they want, you know, a place where you can, it's not just a hotel, it's a home base for all the travel that's going on.
I think one of the key messages from the emergency folks in that press conference was, if you happen to be driving around, do not stop your car at the side of the road, and especially on the side of the highway, and get out to watch the eclipse. That is always a danger.
Can you imagine if there's somebody out there that doesn't know anything about the eclipse and then is driving and pulls over because they notice what's happening? Yeah, that would be kind of terrifying. So that's something they're saying. Do not try to pull over and watch the eclipse from the side of the road. That is a hazard. So something to keep in mind out there.
Now, we mentioned the home opener for the Guardians, and the cynic that I am, Steph. No, the cynic that I am, we had that discussion earlier this week. But I've seen snow, right? Guardians openers have been snowed out before.
We have April birthdays, Glenn.
Yes.
Like, we have had many birthdays.
We know
snow.
This. So, I mean, there is the potential that there could be cloud cover. People could be jockeying for the best viewing spot. The weather is a big factor in this, obviously.
Yeah, and in another emergency management press conference that happened back in February, they had a meteorologist there who said that even if there is full cloud coverage, which is possible in Ohio in April, usually it's partly cloudy at this time of year, you will still see something. It's still going to get really dark, darker than it is with the cloud coverage, but we won't be able to see that the moon passing over the sun, or sun passing over the moon. I don't really know which one it is. I don't know how science works, but we will still be able to see. I'm just a journalist guy. No, I'm just teasing. But you'll still be able to see it get dark. But yeah, absolutely. That's another factor too. The other thing is that you have some towns that are in the path of totality, and then the next town over isn't. So you actually will get a better view if you are in the other town. So you could see people just going right up into the time to get the best view.
You know, you have all kinds of like Leslie Knope quotes at your desk from Parks and Rec. I'm gonna have that Anna Huntsman. I don't know how science works.
Oh, great.
That's the quote from Anna Huntsman. No, I'm kidding. I'm just teasing. I wanted to mention real quick, Stephanie, and we've only got about a minute on this. Mentor Public Schools Board of Education narrowly rejecting two book challenges, the board voting 3-2 against banning two books that some parents objected to being in the district's libraries. There's some video, of course, of the parents objecting. It gets intense, like it normally does. Just give us a quick kind of synopsis on some of the books, some of the issues, and ultimately why it was decided against banning these books.
Right. Well, up for debate were two books. One was called Right Now, Real Kids Speaking Up for Change. It's for elementary school kids, preschoolers to third grade. It has short profiles of kids involved in activism, like Greta Thunberg, the climate activist, and Jazz Jennings, the transgender activist. And the other one was called, and I've never read it, Empire Storms. And it's part of the Throne of Glass series. It's for grades 10 through 12, and it was available at the high school library. And parents, people who were concerned, said they opposed the sex scenes in the Empire of Storms book and then the content about climate change and transgender people in the other.
Ultimately, the board again voted 3-2 to not ban those books. We wanted to end with this. The music world and fans in Northeast Ohio especially mourning the loss this week of singer and musician Eric Carmen. The Brush High School alum and Lyndhurst native found success as a lead singer of the 70s group The Raspberries. He went on to a solo career with such hits as Hungry Eyes from the Dirty Dancing soundtrack and All By Myself. Carmen's wife Amy announcing his passing in a statement on the singer's website. Eric Carmen was 74. We leave you this week with Go All the Way from the Raspberries, a hit that found new popularity after being included on the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtrack. For the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We're on Twitter, now X at Sound of Ideas. St. Patrick's Day Parade is Sunday, stepping off at 2:04. That's an hour later than usual. Organizers say to give people time to go to church. Parade route begins at East 18th and East 22nd Street. If you missed any part of the program, find us online. Listen to Sound of Ideas podcast. You can get it on the podcast app. The re-air of this program is tonight at 9 on 89.7 WKSU. The TV version Ideas tonight at 7:30 on WVIZ PBS. Stay safe this weekend. Go all Ohio teams in March Madness.
Absolutely.
I'm Glenn Forbes in for Mike McIntyre. Thanks so much for listening.
Go Flashes.